Okay, so we're back on after a short break. And so you talked about going to Rice Institute and that there wasn't a fee for tuition. And I'm wondering, did you apply to other places as well when you were thinking about college? Did you apply to other schools?
I suppose I had the idea I would go to the University of Texas. When every Texas valedictorian has an automatic, in those days, $50 scholarship to a state university. So I thought I would go to a state university, and girls didn't go to A&M in those days. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One thing we didn't cover that is really significant, at the time that I grew up, there were, and excuse the expressions, but I'm going to say, there were Mexicans, and I'm deliberately using those words because they were considered somewhat less than people. And that was the society that you grew up in. Now, we had some Mexican girls in our classes. We didn't have any men, but we had some of the girls. But they stayed off to their side, and they never interacted with anybody else. I don't know whether any of them ever graduated or not. Segregation existed. It was very, very strong. Jews were very much, although we ended up finding some very, there was one Jew in Pasadena, and he had the jewelry store, and he was a well-respected man. There were no Negroes, none. That's what I grew up in. That was the society. And I'm not very proud of it, but it is what it was, and that's just the way it was. And I have learned in my lifetime that prejudice is the worst evil of everything, and it's the root of all of our problems. Okay, enough philosophy.
That's a big thing to say, that a lot of people wouldn't revisit their upbringing like that. So,
my best friend, I have two best friends now. One is the girl, she's in the picture book in there, Jackie. She and I were classmates at Rice, and I introduced her on a blind date to her husband, who was an ex-boyfriend of mine. And my other best friend forever lives down the street here. She's a woman in her 40s, a black woman. And that we can be best friends after what I grew up in, that would just not have even been possible. But I think part of who I am is I have learned that I must not be prejudiced, and I think I am not prejudiced anymore. But I am well aware that prejudices exist, and women face prejudice too. And unfortunately, you may not have observed, but surely you have, I think that the prejudice against women has been increasing in our society in the United States in the last 10 or 15 years at a rate that is terrifies me. It really does. I fear for the future of women.
And why do you think that is?
Why do I think it happened? I don't know why it happened. I don't know why it's that way.
Can you say a little more how that might influence careers for women? If you see sort of this, I don't want to use the term backtracking, but sort of a...
Oh, I think that's exactly what's happening, is backtracking.
So what does that mean for women in careers now?
That means that they're going to have a much harder time. They're going to be held to double standards or triple standards. See, when I started my career, that was when everybody go out and hire women and make women and integrate women. That was when it started. So I was kind of lucky. But I still ran into problems. And I just really, I think that the prejudice that we face as women is as dangerous as the prejudice that we face because we are a Jew or a black or a Irish or whatever. Prejudice is wrong. Okay, sorry, got on my soapbox. Now, like so many people when I went to Rice, I felt like I was sort of free to be myself. I didn't have to really follow the directions of my parents anymore. So many people do that when they leave home. And I finally found out there were other people that was as smart as I was.
Was there something in particular about direction of your parents you were not wanting to follow, or it was just a sense of it's really your choice now?
I had a feeling of you had to be absolutely proper and prim in your behavior. When we went shopping in downtown Houston in the late 40s, ladies wore hat and gloves and hosiery and high heels, or heels. That was how you dressed to go shopping. Everybody did it.
When did that change?
Ooh. 1980, maybe. It's a long time. For a long time, we had this proper way to dress idea. We were talking about this at my stuffed animal project this morning, on when we could wear, we couldn't wear jeans to school. In fact, you couldn't even wear pants. And this went on until it, well into the 1970.
And so thinking about starting in college, what kinds of things were you wearing on campus and to
class?
Well,
you wore dresses, you wore skirts and blouses and
mm-hmm.
and shoes. And oh, at Rice we had on Friday, the men had to wear a dress shirt and a tie. Oh, first of all, as a freshman you wore a beanie, which was a little round cap that had a little tiny, sort of like a baseball cap, only it wasn't as big as a baseball cap.
Women wore it?
Men and women both wore the beanie. Mm-hmm. And you had to wear the beanie all the time. But on Friday, the girls had to wear a green dress with a white pinafore. And the boys had to wear a white shirt with some kind of tie, particular color or something. And you wear your beanie, of course. And you had to wear that all the first semester. Well, my mother made my pinafore. Well, she made it a very plain apron-style pinafore. And the girls from River Oaks, which is the hoity-toity part of town here, theirs was all frilly with multiple ruffles and everything that they made. Must have spent 2 hours ironing every week. Mine was very plain-looking.
And so, how was it transitioning? You talked a little bit about that freedom. What did you think of Rice as a school and the campus and, you know, that transition to adjusting to coursework and making friends and everything like that? How did that go for you?
Well, it went very well, really. What's done today at Rice is not the same as what I went through. When I was a freshman, we had one morning or afternoon of orientation or something, And they broke us up in small groups and led us around the campus and told us that this is the chemistry building and this is this building and that building and this is where you go and everything. There were no facilities for women to live on campus at all. There were facilities for men. North, south, east, and west hall. And they all had they had one dining facility. I'm not really sure about that because I wasn't a man, so I don't know. But they did have those facilities. Mm-hmm. Some of the professors lived in the single professors lived in the men's dormitories also. Mm-hmm. They had Rice is an absolutely beautiful campus. It was planned from the very beginning of what the layout would be, and they had followed the plan, and they had an excellent staff. Tony was the head gardener there from the time it started and through my years, and he perfection. If you want to see azaleas, that's the place to go to see azaleas. If you go in the main campus at Rice, there's these 100-year-old azalea bushes, you know, on both sides, and when they bloom in the spring, it's breathtaking. It's just gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. It really is. Anyway, they took us around the campus, and then they showed us, and they built in, when they built it, some funny things. The campus was designed after the Italian style to take advantage of the prevailing winds for coolness. This was before air conditioning, because it was built in the early 1900s. And so it was built with respect to that, to try and use that. And they have a lot of colonnades around carving. They brought over guys from Italy that were stone carvers to do the carvings and all. So there's some special carvings on the oldest building on campus. As you go through the main entrance, they call it Sally Port. And there's four big corners like this, with big caulk. And on the top of them are these figures. And one is the freshman, one is the sophomore, one is the junior, and then there's the bewildered senior with his tassel and all cap on his face. You have to go and see. That's exactly how they look. And then on the front of the building, inside quadrangle, there's smaller columns that are, just above walking height and stuff. And on top of each one of those, on the four sides, are carvings representing the Greek philosophers and I've forgotten who else. And there's an echo chamber in the physics building where you can call up and all. So they showed us all this. And then we ended up in the center of the academic quadrangle where, at that time, the statue of the founder, William Marsh Rice, was. And they seat you on this little... Well, the statue's in the middle, and then there's this bench sitting thing around, and so you all sit down. And then they proceed to tell you the story of his murder. Have you heard of the murder?
No.
Well, Mr. Rice had a lot of money, and they kept trying to get him to form a high school for the boys in Houston, and he wouldn't do it. And instead, he led forward to form this institute. And he went off at the end of his life to New York, and he had a lawyer up there and a butler, and the lawyer decided to make a false will to try to steal his money and had the butler poison him. And Captain Baker here in Houston jumped on a steamboat and got up there real fast and was able to, stop it and get the money and preserve the money so that they could form Russ. And you're sitting on his tomb. He's buried here. Well, they no longer have that. In fact, they've just now had a big to-do at Rice, and they have moved the statue to a less prominent place because we now have Negroes on campus, and or black people, whichever there's a proper term. I don't know. Let's be sure to make the right one in the book, in the recording. But they apparently were disturbed by seeing him. They were reminded that he was a slave owner. Well, My ancestors were slave owners too. It's a way of life. And but if it'll make them happy, that's all right. At any rate, so that was that part of getting oriented. Then we started our classes. We, as a science engineering major, if you were a male, you had to take physical training, but they didn't have them for girls then, so I didn't have that. So I lucked out. I no longer had to take PE at any time after ninth grade. But then all freshmen, regardless of your major, take Math 100, which was Introduction to Calculus. You take English 100, which is theme writing, to make sure you knew how to write. You took math, you took English, and you took history. You could have your choice of whether you took American history or world history, and I took American history. Okay. And then everybody had to take a science, and if you were an academic major, you took biology. But if you were an engineering major, you took chemistry and physics. So is that five solids? Yeah, so I took five solids. And then the guys who were in ROTC also had to take ROTC. So they were really busy. We had classes 6 days a week. It went on until noon. All the lectures were from 8 a.m. to 12 noon. And then any laboratories you had were in the afternoons. As a SE major, you had a lab for chemistry, you had a lab for physics. Oh, we had another course. I knew I had another course. That was our engineering drawing course. We had to take engineering drawing, which was just a one-hour lecture and a three-hour sitting down and drawing. I can do an ink drawing. Did you ever try them?
I took drawing, basically, yes, in high school.
But you took it into high school.
And then I also took it in college. Yeah.
And you did ink drawings?
Yes.
Yeah, I've got some stories on that.
Then computers came, so.
And then computers came, yeah, well. But no, until you've dealt with doing a drawing in India ink, where you hold the ink between your nubs, you put your ink on your little pens like this, and you push the pen down to get the width of line that you want, and then you draw it elevated like this so that you don't smear.
Mm-hmm.
It's real art.
It is.
Oh.
So at Rice, as a freshman, so you're coming in, you said you met people just as smart as you were,
mm-hmm.
and freshmen, they're all mixed depending on the emphasis, it sounds like. So you're in classes with people with a lot of different interests.
No, all of my classes were all science engineering majors.
Okay.
Because we had our our English classes, we were segregated. We weren't with the other people.
Okay.
That would have been the only one where we could have been. Now, the history class, we had other people in the history class. That was a mixed class of everybody. But our English, we were segregated.
So how?
And our English professor was a young jerk, young man, fresh out of the University of Chicago. And he held us personally responsible for all the horrors of the atom bomb.
Oh.
And we had to write a paper a week for, 30 weeks or whatever it was and all. And at the... our grades were, one was an A and five was failure. And after like 6 weeks or so, we hadn't had a single one appear on anybody's writing in the whole class. My class was, 20 people or so. The ratio at Rice was very small. For most of my classes were 20 people or less of that type of class. Now the physics and the chemistry were large classes because everybody was in there, and our math class. But for math, I had Hubert Evelyn Bray. He was English ancestry, and he had come to Rice with whichever the first mathematician who came to Rice was, whatever his name was, and completed his doctorate there, and then became professor and he spent his entire career there. That man was one of the most brilliant math instructors I have ever heard in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And he made so easy and so beautiful. Of course, he'd probably done it at that point for 30 years, but he Nevertheless, I mean, he was fantastic. And then, but as an SE major, you had the 3 hours, and then you had another hour lab immediately after, where the student advisors came in to help you do your problems if you needed help.
So how many other women were?
My freshman year, I think there were 6 women who were trying out the
in SME.
In this SE program. And at
so where did everybody live if you're not on campus?
Well, there were a couple of women that had houses within a few blocks or something of the campus, and they had half a dozen people live with them. The girls that lived in Houston lived at home. Now, my saga, every year was different for me, but I started off through the advisor women or something. We had discovered a family that lived within walking distance of the campus that had a bedroom that they would rent to 2 girls. And I had a girl, Ernestine, my very good friend from many years ago, who also came to Rice as an academic major. And so we rented the bedroom together for that first semester. And that's where I lived. And other girls did the same thing throughout. Wherever you could find a place to live, that's where you lived. And Rice did not have, and still does not have, sororities or fraternities. At the time I went there, the big things were the Architecture Society and the Engineering Society, which were mainly all male, although there were girls in both disciplines.
So did these 6 women persevere, or did some of them?
No, I did.
1 out of 6.
Mm-hmm. Most of them dropped out their first year.
And when you were attending your classes, were you sitting in the same, like sitting with the men, or was the room split up, or how did that
work?
Just
you sat wherever you wanted to.
Okay.
So how did the men treat you?
Well, they learned pretty soon that they treated me like a lady. I developed selective deafness. I never heard a bad word or anything like that. And so they respected me. And they learned pretty quickly that, you know, I could do the work, and so we just did it.
Selective deafness, meaning they said something, you just chose not
to listen. I just didn't
hear it.
And this, pretty soon they stopped saying anything. Didn't take very long.
Can you give an example of what they might have said? Or?
Oh, bitch, for instance, or maybe damn. Damn, whatever foul word you could think of, you know, they would say, and I just wouldn't hear it. And it wouldn't, maybe they would be maybe trying to be talking about me, and, you know, knowing that I could overhear if I wanted to, but I just pretended it didn't even happen, and pretty soon they just quit.
And how did professors react to you as a woman and interact with you?
You were just one of their students. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, that was it. Mm-hmm. Now this one guy, the English professor, this first guy, he was, well, we had a real problem with him, because we had 1 or 2 guys in that class who could really write. Now, I never was really good at writing. I got better, I think, as years went by, but at that point in my life, I was not a terribly good writer, and I recognized that. But these people had, you know, some people have the touch early. Well, they had the touch, and their work was really one quality work, or a quality work, as most people would call it. But you normally, in a class like that, you'll have a range of grades. But to have as many on the very low marks as he had, just, it didn't do justice to the things. Now, as a part of the freshman, we were told to address by the president at those days, look to the right, look to the left. This is at the matriculation address. One of you won't be here next week, next year. One of you won't be here next year. They still were flunking people out, even though they tried to make sure to get people to, but I guess, anyway. No, we worked very hard. Everybody went to the football games on Saturdays. So you finished off class at noon, and then you would rush over to the stadium for the 2 o'clock kickoff, if it was an afternoon game. And then you would go out on Saturday night, if you had a date, and drink. Or go to a honky-tonk and dance a little bit or something. And then Sunday morning, if you could sleep in, you slept in. Now, I never did what I did on Sundays. I went out to Pasadena and washed my clothes. Got my clothes clean. And then you started studying again because you were back at the books. Now, I had, so as a freshman, I had engineering drawing and physics and chemistry labs in the afternoons, plus the extra hour of math lab. So I had a pretty heavy load, and that was pretty similar to what I ended up with, for 5 years.
So how did you find that versus your high school from an academic standpoint? Was this just another?
Oh, it was tremendously challenging.
Even for you?
Oh, yes. It was very hard. Yeah. I had to actually work for a change. And if you've never had to work and you have to work all of a sudden, that's a big change. And math was, I really liked math, and it was so easy. And physics, I thought, was extremely hard. But one thing was, the reason physics was hard, we hadn't had the calculus that you needed to know in order to understand the physics. So we're taking calculus at the same time that we're trying to understand. So that's why it was so hard. Now, my husband went to he went in Tulsa, a very large high school, and he had had calculus in high school. Did you have calculus in high school?
Yes, sir.
That makes a huge difference. Huge difference. So, and we had a mixture, see, in my class. I mean, some of the people that had it, I didn't realize at the time that they had the advantage, but that was it. It was different. I remember the first test I ever had was in the American history. Oh, the American history professor, I guess the first week or the second week, he has his weekly test, or maybe topic test every 2 weeks, whatever it was. And he had given us a map of whatever we were studying, and we had to be able to get that map if you give you 10 things to draw on the map, you have to be able to draw them on the map real quick, and that was, that was 30 points or something that you could get towards your grade. So everybody, you got that map down solid, oh, solid. And then it would give you these essay-type questions. And people would just, right. I've always, breaking it down to the essentials, been very, very, so I didn't write reams and reams and reams. Well, I decided I'd really study hard for that first test. And I remember sitting up and studying until like 3 a.m. or something, taking no dose to stay awake.
Taking what?
No dose. N-O-D-O-Z-E.
I don't know if
it's a stimulant of some sort to keep you awake.
It was like having a monster drink or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I stayed up and studied, and then I went and took that test at 8 a.m. And I made a C on it, a 3, which is a C. And I said, never again. And I never did again, and I did much better.
Never again staying up?
I'm never again staying up all night and prepare for a test.
Yeah.
If you don't know it, learn it as you go along. You can't cram it in at the last minute. That helped a lot.
So you were kind of challenged maybe for the first time academically. Did you have spare time to do any extracurricular?
Oh, yes, yes. Somehow or other, what we had, instead of sororities and fraternities, I told you the two big men's societies, the women had what were called literary societies. And this was essentially just the women's club, you know, get together and chit chat and have a good time and drink coffee, whatever you want to do, and talk about men, whatever you want to do as a group of women getting together. Well, unfortunately, with the total number of women on campus had increased over the years, but the literacy, they started off with one literacy society, and then they had two, and then they had three, and then they had four. Well, by the time I got there, that only took care of half of the women on campus. And so the women's advisor, whatever she was called, decided the time had come that they should have more women's literary societies. First of all, we went through a pledge time where all of these literary societies had parties and invited all of the freshmen girls to the parties. And some of them were in these River Oaks home. These are the multi-million dollar places and things like that. Well, I got invited to the first round, of course, along with everybody else. And I don't think I had a single invitation to any of the second rounds. They had a series of, you know, two, and then they decided who they wanted to ask, if, do you want to be a member of the society? And, well, I wasn't the only one like that. There were a lot of others. So we ended up, so half the freshman girls get into the societies and half of them don't. So the other half of us, somehow or other, the advisor women gathered them up and divided them into four groups and told us that we would form literary societies. I can't remember exactly. This was a long time ago that this happened. I could ask my friend Jackie. She may remember. And we were told that, you know, you really need to have a group of women to enjoy the full college experience, yakety yak yak. And so we formed our literary societies. And you had to find out somebody to, okay, the names of the society were people famous in literature or in the history of Rice. Elizabeth Baldwin was, I think, one of Rice's wives or something. And we chose for ours Shelley Rice. Sarah Lane was one of the first women advisors to women. In fact, I think she was still there then. She was one. Let's see. Pallas Athene. Elizabeth Baldwin. Sarah Lane. Owen Wister. That was one. That was the Owls. So we were Shelley Rice and the other three new ones. I can't remember their names. Isn't that terrible? Whatever they were called. Anyway, we had to find a name and all, and we had to write our bylaws and stuff. Well, that was the other thing I had done. I took an early interest in constitutional law and bylaws, and so I was always the parliamentarian in whatever group I was in, and modified the bylaws and wrote the bylaws or whatever it was. And so anyway, we formed that group. It was a group of about 30 to 35, I think, in each one of the groups. Maybe 30 was there. We're a large group. But we found some time where that we could get together on the campus one afternoon a week for a couple of hours. And then we started doing things like we would all go to the beach together, or we would have a slumber party, or we really didn't do anything, just get together and gossip.
But none of those women were in SME, right?
Women in my group? Oh yeah, there were some chemistry majors and stuff around.
There were,
you know,
okay.
You know. Nobody else was in engineering, though. Nobody in engineering but me.
So it gave you a group where you kind of belonged, then?
Women, you know, it's just more people, you know. It was different. It was nice. I mean, it gave you somebody to where that you could talk a little bit and everything. You know, and it was good for me because about that time was the end of the semester, and my friend decided to leave and go to Florida for her heartthrob, and so I was left with, you know, no roommate, and so there I was the middle of the year, and I can't afford to stay there and pay double rent, so I've got to talk about many. So I went and talked to the Pfizer women, and they had just had a Jewish family come and asked if they had anybody who would needed a place to live. And their house was, do you know where the Highway 59 leaves downtown and goes out towards Sugar Land?
Mm-hmm.
It goes right through their house.
Okay.
At Shepherd
mm-hmm.
Street. And so that was, it was away from campus.
Yeah.
So when my daddy at that time had a used car business, and so he was able to let me have a car to drive, and I could live there and not pay any room and board. And I had to, the job that I had was to be with their daughter during the week so that the man and his wife could go out and take clients out. He was a $1 million life insurance salesman, and he would take them out and schmooze them, you know, Monday through Friday. And so on the weekends, I was free. And that's where I lived the rest of that that year. Now, I've said money. I got to talk about money. Remember I told you I had typing. Well, when I finished, graduated from high school, I was 17 years old because my birthday was in October. And I had worked before that time to make money walking door to door selling Christmas cards. And I made a good amount of money doing that for several years. And I had worked one Christmas selling jewelry in a jewelry store, and I had done babysitting to make money. So I had worked during my growing up years. But I wanted to see if I couldn't make more money because I knew typing, and I wanted to get, you know, in a quote plant, you know, business type thing. And so I applied at the Champion Paper Company, which is right there in Pasadena. And it turned out that their engineering department, the woman who was the secretary for the department, was going to get married. And their engineering department was situated way back in the back 40, away from everybody else, so there wasn't any other clerical person to take her place. And it was very specialized because she had to be able to run the blueprint machine. And so I was going to Rice to study, you know, science engineering, and I could type. So they hired me, and I spent 2 weeks learning her job. And she also took her vacation, but she also took an extra 2 weeks off, so she was gone for 4 weeks. And then I worked for 4 weeks as the office person or secretary person in the engineering department of the company. And of course, I made a fabulous amount of money. I've forgotten how much it was, you know, $30 a week or something, some huge amount. And then I got late, of course, that was it, so I had to, but I was home for 2 weeks, and they called me to come back because they had, somebody else was going, and they needed somebody for that office. So I went back and worked again, and I ended up working most of the summer, and I continued to work for them after my freshman, sophomore, before my freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior years, so I worked there for 4 years. In the subsequent years, I worked the entire summer. And I made enough money that I was able to pay for my books and my tuition. So I ended up the summer with a little over $200. And, you know, that's because basically my books and tuition cost, let me see that. Okay, so working for Champion Paper provided me with money so that I was able to pay for my books and my tuition each of the 5 years with the money that I had earned. And so my parents just had my room and board just, quote, and transportation fees. So that helped tremendously.
And now, was there some kind of tuition fee as well? Because I think you'd said initially there wasn't
tuition. There is no tuition. No.
Okay.
My books were a little over $100 a year, like $125 or something on the big years. And the fees, there was a student activity fee that covered your admission to the ball games. There was a library fee. Anyway, the fees were like $85 or $90 a year.
Hmm. Wow.
And that was all. Now, of course, you had to buy blue books and stuff to take notes with, but basically, the equipment wasn't very much. It's truly amazing. Oh, I had lab fees. That's why, because you have to have all the flasks and stuff to break and all the chemicals and stuff. But they weren't. It wasn't very much either. The total fees that I paid were under $100 a year for 5 years, and I made enough working for Champion to pay those, which was really good.
Were there other learnings you got from the work at Champion?
I learned how big of companies, because I worked in every office in the facility, including the plant manager's office. I worked in the chemistry lab where they made milk carton stock, so they had biological controls and stuff like that. I worked in the engineering department. I worked in the pulp department. I worked in the shipping and receiving department. I worked in the purchasing department. I did, they bring in huge rail cars of pine logs to use to make the paper from, and I typed the names of those rail cars over and over and over. I was pretty good at typing at that. I worked with personnel department where they did all of the personnel work. What do they call it? Human relations nowadays. So yes, I learned how a big company is organized. I learned about reports. Okay, I had to, when I would work in the laboratory, I had to make the Ditto copies. Ditto is that purple stuff you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't have a Ditto machine. We had a jelly roll of, it was literally a gel on a roll that you could roll out. And you would make your master and type it so that you have to mirror image stuff. And then you would take the master and lay it on this jelly roll, and you put a little piece of paper under on the corner so that you could lay it down and pull it up without breaking the gel. And the ink would go onto the jelly roll. Then you'd take a piece of paper and roll it out in the exact place, and that would make a copy. And we could make about 15 or 20 copies that would be legible in that fashion. And that's the kind of machine that I used to make the dip. In later years, in other facilities, I learned that there were machines that you could rotate and turn the crank, and it would pull the paper through, and it had a liquid thing that made the ink transfer to the paper. We used slide rules because we didn't have calculators in those days, and so all of our calculations were done, and the men used an actual stick. We called them a stick. Do you know what a slide rule is?
Vaguely. Yeah.
Oh, well, my daughter still has one. I don't have it. But I had, instead of having a stick, I had a circular one. Mm-hmm. And the stick is about this long. It has 8 scales on it, and there's a middle stick that rolls back and forth this way. And you can do multiplying and dividing and exponential and all kinds of calculations for this. I could do the same thing with my little circular thing, where instead of moving the sticks, I move the indicators. There's also a round one that's this big, that's the equivalent of a 24-inch rule. But anyway, that's what I did all of my calculations with when I was at Rice.
So you had to buy one?
Well, yeah, about that. Yeah, you had to buy that your freshman year.
So why did you buy the circular and not the stick?
So it fit in my purse.
Ah, okay.
And you had also mentioned a blueprint machine, I believe.
Oh, that was at. And in the engineering department there, they had this gigantic machine where engineering drawings generally are big like this, because you've got to make them big enough where you can write stuff on them, and you end up with an engineering. You've got a lot of information on there. And so in working with them, you make prints, and then you mark up on the prints what you want to do, and then you put the stuff onto your drawing.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way that you don't actually work on your original film drawing. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That was the olden way of doing it. And you have to, when you make changes, you had to you have your original drawing of whatever it is at the first stage, and you have the first stage of it, and you sign off on the, you've got a certain thing, you get it approved. And then as you go along and you make additional changes and stuff to it, any change you make, or addition, you put a little triangle with it, with a number in it, and then you have over here on the drawing a log of the changes that are made to that drawing, so that people can tell what stage and what has happened and what's going on. And we have different kinds of engineering drawing depending upon what. I ended up doing project engineering, so I dealt with everything. But the first concept may just be for, let's see, it's really hard to, I'm trying to think of a good way to boxes.
You're talking like a process drawing.
Yeah. Even before a project drawing.
A project drawing.
Okay,
so
you're
like
going to have, you're planning a dinner party or something. Okay, and you've got your menu, so you've got meat, salad, so on. So each one of these would be a box. Hmm. And then you bring those boxes together, and then you've got to have somebody bring in the flowers. But the whole idea is the dinner party. Now the dinner party is part of the celebration, it's part of something else. You can do this in stages, and at each one of these you get more and more detail. And finally you've got to actually, if you've got the dinner party, a particular dessert to make, for instance, then you've got to have the recipe with all of the specifications for it, and you've got to go out and buy the equipment. And so every one of these in engineering can be a drawing. If, for instance, piping, we end up with what we call a spool drawing. A spool drawing is the actual drawing of the piping over there at the sink. You can see the piping and the piping underneath the sink. And we have drawings actually look like that, because then you can take that and you can measure how long it is and what are the valves that you need. And the valve that you put on there, you end up on that valve, you have a little number by it, and that tells the people doing it that they need to buy a certain type of valve to put on in that particular place on that particular pipeline. And those are engineering drawings.
And so was this something you were learning in your coursework and also had exposure to at this job, or was one place more?
The ones at the engineering company, it was an actually operating plant. So those drawings would be where they were doing some revisions to something, and it had all sorts of moving mechanical equipment that they had, and so those would be very detailed mechanical drawings.
Mm.
At the school, what you were learning in the school was the techniques of how do you make a drawing, how do you draw a line, and how do you depict something, and how do you depict a pump? We have a symbol for a pump. It looks something like that.
So it's actually quite fortunate that you could apply
see
it in action at the same time.
Yeah, I learned a lot of stuff about engineering by working at the company, as well as learning all about how a big company, a manufacturing facility works. And it was really excellent experience for me.
Because you really had not been exposed to something like that prior, other than, laundry or other businesses.
No, just, I hadn't had any experiences, anything like that.
Was it intimidating, or were you curious?
I was just curious. Always fascinating to find out all the things, and the government regulations, and the, with respect to the personnel work that we did, and the fact that they made, the different kinds of material, the calendar side and the non-calendar side, and the main material for Time magazine. So the paper had to be finished on both sides, calendared. That's the ironing process. And that's why most paper you have has a side that has a finer finish than the other side. It's Paper's really interesting. In fact, most things are interesting.
And I think you noted in some things you'd written that you had some other jobs during the academic year as well?
Oh, yes. I didn't have any during my freshman year.
Okay.
But when it came to my sophomore year, I worked for the man who had taught us the engineering drawing the first year as one of his lab assistants. Now, you've got to remember that we took our drawing course in a Quonset hut. Do you know what a Quonset hut is?
Mm-hmm.
World War II. Has a round roof like this, and it's long, and it's metal, and it's hot in the summer and freezing in the winter, and horrible, anyway. So that's where we had it, and I was the student assistant to help these people try to pass engineering drawing. And this was when we had the guys coming back from being in the service. And we had one guy in my group, and he was a rather pudgy fellow. And he sweat and sweat and sweat. Like, I mean, it just kind of poured off of him. And we had to do these ink drawings. And I told you how it's very difficult to do ink drawings. And in order for him to pass and do his ink drawing, I got a huge towels or a bunch of rags or something, I forgot what. And I stood over him and kept wiping his forehead while he did his drawing, and he passed. And that's what I remember about that year, was I can't remember his name, but I wanted everybody in my group, you know, to be able to pass. You know, I had to help a lot of others. But he was the one that took the most help. And it was trying to stay dry so that you didn't sweat. You drop one drop of sweat in there and that ink just goes big. You have to start off. Oh. Only somebody who's made... If you ever try to make something and just have it go all over the place, that was doing ink drawings. It was something. See, I did that my sophomore year. My junior year, what did I do? I don't remember what my job was. Oh, that may have been the year that I came to Pasadena. And one year, I got a job babysitting in a church in Pasadena on Sundays. And that's how I made money during the school year. One year I guess it must have been my senior year. You take your first chemical engineering course in your junior year. Before then, you're just taking the introductory things. After I took the introduction course to chemical engineering, I graded the papers for that the following year. What else did I can't remember what else it, but if I could get a little job, I got little jobs.
Mm. And how are you balancing those jobs with your schoolwork? Because I know you said, especially in that first either semester or year, I can't remember, you were talking about, you know, taking a lot of courses.
Well, so I took a lot of courses every year.
Mm-hmm.
Every year we took at least 5 solids, and our drawing courses were extras. So your freshman and sophomore year, you took 5 courses, strict academic, you know, and which had two labs, at least 2 labs.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the drawing course in addition to that. And then our last 3 years, you just took 5 solids.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back on all those courses, what was the hardest one for you?
Probably thermodynamics. What I ended up doing.
I was going to say. What was the easiest?
The straight math courses. What was the most interesting? The plant trips.
Why were those interesting?
To actually see things and to see what they were. Saying. And of course, the final plant design course, at, you know, the ultimate capstone course of chemical engineers.
So yeah.
Can we talk a little more about those plant trips? Because to me, that's a helpful eye into things in practice, right, in the real world, which you got at the paper company.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We took our plant trips. Okay, let's see. It was the year that I voted for Eisenhower, so I was 21 years old that fall, and I got to vote. So whichever year, I was 17, 18, 19, 20. So it would have been my senior year. It was during our fourth year. And Professor Hartsook was the one that did the plant trips. And of course, he'd been doing it for 1,000 years and everything. And what
was
he did.
Was he the head of the department?
He's head of the department, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Pappy Hartsook, great guy. More about him later. We'd have a meeting and he would tell us where we were going and what we were going to see. And then we would go out and go through the plant tour, and it would be about 3 hours or so. And living in Houston, being in Houston, we could go and just do one a week. The students, probably you went on a trip where you did a whole lot of visits, right, one after the other. See, so I had a real advantage in only doing one a week. Mm-hmm. And then we had to write a report on what we had seen and everything. And everybody had to write their own report. You didn't do this as a group effort. So I think I had a really good plant trip experiences. And I can remember the first thing that we went to was a sewage treatment plant. Chemical engineers work in sewage treatment plants. Okay. And so you did all of that. Then we went to a place that made the tiles for the flooring. Not the vinyl tile, but the other kind, the asphalt tiles that people made. Okay, that was something. Then we went to a steel mill. You can see there's a wide variety of things that we've seen. We went to the Imperial Sugar Factory out in Sugar Land. We went to the Coca-Cola Bottling Company. We went to the Nabisco Cracker Manufacturing Facility. Then we went to Dow Chemical down in Freeport. And then we went to Shell Oil Refinery. And then the final one that we went to was the Pabst Blue Ribbon beer.
Which was a wonderful variety, right, of different processes, different
industries. It's a huge, huge variety of, and it showed to me what a wide, made me very glad I was going into chemical engineering, because there's such a wide variety of what people can do.
And what kinds of things were you seeing? What were you learning? What was your Professor Hartsook like? You know,
he told you what the process was that we'd be seeing, and we would see that, and we would actually get to see the equipment and to see what a pump looked like, and to see these big valves, and And the beer thing, the great big thing that has to be kept so very clean where they are processing the hops and stuff. And the brewmaster he was huge, but they had this, but he had to go inside and make sure it was clean enough and everything. It's seeing all of this, and then you got to see the mechanics of the filling of the bottles and all, and the things they had to do to keep it especially clean for the food processing industries. And the you just saw so much, and you were up close.
So how did you kind of there weren't a lot of women working in these fields then. So what did you do for like PPE, personal protective equipment? And
well, I wore pants when we did all the, went on these trips.
Okay.
And we didn't wear hard hats, as I recall. Maybe if we did, the companies gave us hard hats when we got there and took them back up when we left. We had to wear closed shoes like this, but we didn't wear steel-toed.
Were there safety glasses or not always?
I never remember wearing any safety glasses.
Were you ever feeling a little like in danger walking through any of these plants? Sometimes
no.
They're quite intimidating. Large equipment, things like that.
No, that didn't bother me.
Did you ever see any women at these places?
No. Don't recall any operators or anything. It's worth talking about operating trying to remember who the steel workers were. No, I don't remember any women at all. But that didn't register on me.
Right. So you're seeing this huge variety. Was there some that really piqued your interest more than others, or it was just like a candy store?
I know I didn't want to work in a sewage plant.
Ah, okay.
No, it wasn't any particular one. They're all interesting.
Your class colleagues, did they end up working in some of these industries, or how did they respond to some of this?
Well, I'm not sure where everybody ended up, but I think most of us went to work for oil and chemical companies. One guy I know went into nuclear, for sure. Hard to remember. We had one person in the class while I was working at the Champion Paper. He worked for some chemical or oil company. I don't remember which one, for four summers. And he went to work when we finished our fifth year. When we finished our fifth year, the degree was called a Bachelor of Science in Chemical Engineering. And I went to work for Shell, and there was a guy there who had a so-called Master of Science, and I discovered that my bachelor's was better than his master's.
Better in what way?
I had a better grasp of the fundamentals than he did. Rice taught the fundamentals, and that course, it was better than the master's course. Yeah. It was a very good, and later on they did change the name to a degree to a master's degree. But
so here
the guy I was telling you about that worked for the company, he went to work for $450 a month. And I went to work for $409 a month with Shell. Looking for a job was an interesting experience. They came to the campus and interviewed and all this kind of stuff, all the big companies and everything did. And I was interested in Mallinckrodt Chemicals in St. Louis. And they invited me to come up there for an interview. And so I went, I got on the airplane and flew for the first time in my life. Yeah, it was quite interesting. And I got up there and went out and interviewed. But I didn't like it because it was out in a not very nice part of town. And I didn't get good vibes.
Why were you interested in them in the first place?
I thought it'd be very interesting working chemicals.
Okay.
See, at that point, you know, I didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. I've just been going to school. I didn't know anything about what it really meant to be working in a chemical company or an oil company or any. You really don't know anything when you get out of school.
Right.
Okay? If that makes any sense.
Can you repeat that one?
You really don't know anything when you get out of school. You think you do, but you really don't. And so I went there, and then I went down to Dow Chemical. I was going to go to Dow, and But then I decided, no, I won't go there, because I found out from some of my colleagues who had gone down there that they, when they went down to interview, they proceeded to give them a psychological test. And that made me decide I didn't want to work for a company that was going to base hiring me on some psychological test, not on my engineering ability.
So it was a psychological test, not for chemical plant operators.
This was for engineers.
Wow.
And it didn't set well with me at all. Mm-hmm. And then I interviewed at Shell, and they made me the offer to work in the refinery. In the way Shell did it then, in those days, they had a lot of engineers, and in the refinery, mostly chemical engineers, that were in their research lab. It really wasn't a research lab. What you were there for was to learn how you solved any operating problems that you had going on. There was another group of people that actually ran the refinery, operators, and did the real work, and there was the administrative group that were also in, some of them who were engineers, the managers and stuff. But the people in the research lab were really backups for when there were strikes, then you had to go out and operate the refinery. Mm-hmm. That was what the real purpose was of them. Well, and this, as I said before, this was at the time when they were starting the push that everybody has to have equal opportunity and everything. So as a woman, I was in real demand.
Was it really a push, though, for equal opportunity?
Oh, yes, my dear. Yes, it was. Yes, it was. They were very proud to have a woman.
Shell was.
Engineer. Oh, yeah.
What about the others?
Oh, the other companies, when they got a woman, they were very proud to get a woman. Yeah.
Okay.
That's the kind of jobs that they would give you. But I got a real job. Shell was very good about that. Like I say, there was other young engineer who was hired at the same time. And we were each given a specific problem child that they had. Mine was in the lube oils plant. And I had to try out a new piece of equipment to be used for extraction. And it was a Pabilniak extractor. And it was a rotating drum. It went very fast, mm-hmm. and so you had the gravity effect separation, and it had multiple stages inside, like a rotating fractionating tower. She's nodding her head, she knows what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, when we put the crude oil in there and did it, the asphalts fell out and blocked all the openings and blocked it. So then I had to have the machinist come over and take this. The first time he comes to do it, he sees a woman, you know. I mean, it was literally the reaction that I got. You know, he was really shocked. But he was happy to do what he needed. And he took it apart, and we found all the little stuff in it and everything. Well, anyway, I was not very successful in getting that to work, and I knew that it wouldn't work even on a... I had an experimental pilot plant size. What you do in engineering is you start with small, if you can, and you scale up from there, generally speaking.
I'm sorry, I think I missed this. Is this part of your interview, or is this when you were actually working?
It was when I was actually working for Shell.
Okay.
I know the interview was Shell. I don't remember much about.
Okay.
But they made me the offer, and I took it. I was made a fairly early decision.
Okay. And so I want to go back for a moment to your college years, and I was wondering if there were any other influential professors or classes or mentors in your undergraduate years.
Right. Let me tell you, the biggest influence I had. At the end of the sophomore year, you know, the program was you had to decide what you would... you have to make a decision at the end of the freshman year whether you're going into civil engineering or not. And at that point, I decided I did not want to go into civil engineering, according to what you'd be taking the following year.
Okay.
So then at the end of the sophomore year, you have your final decision, what are you going to major in. And at that point, I decided mathematics was too easy. Physics was too hard, and I'd already ruled out chemical, and electrical just really didn't appeal to me. It's just, I just didn't feel like an electrical. So that left chemistry or chemical engineering. So I decided to go talk to the department and see what. So I went to the head of the chemistry department, and George Holmes Richter was his name. And he was a very large man, and he was over 6 feet tall, and very large as well. And I was 5 foot five. And I told him, you know, I was trying to decide between chemistry and chemical engineering. And he looked down at me, and I can remember his words. "Miss Stallings, it doesn't make any difference what you major in. You're just going to get married and have a family." And so I left him and went down and found Professor Hartsook. And he was a much shorter man, and also a little rounded. And he said, "Miss Stallings, I would love to have you in my classes. I haven't had a young lady in my classes for, I don't know how many years, 10 years now or something, whatever it was that it had been. And yes, I would very much like to have you in our class." So that's why I became an engineer instead of a chemist.
And
it turned out to be ideal for me.
And, you know, we're in some questions earlier, Gail was asking about, you know, how did it feel when people said things like that? How did it feel to you when the professor said that?
It made me very angry. Very, very angry.
Why?
He was belittling my ability to function as a human being. To fully function, and I felt very insulted at that. I had seen my grandmother and my mother as women who had had very difficult things to overcome and had overcome them in their lives and, you know, had reared their families. I mean, that was their job, what they did, and provided for them financially. I mean, because my mother was a major portion of the financial income of our family, as well as my father. That became very obvious in my high school and college years. And my grandmother, she had spent her whole entire life practically. So I was pretty well, I was insulted. Yeah.
It's interesting, you know, sometimes people that are very capable and smart can do a lot of things. We almost go through a process of deciding, well, I don't want this, I don't want that.
Right.
So you said you didn't want to go civil, and you learned you didn't want to go electrical. What if Professor Hartsock had said, well, you know, maybe this isn't a good fit for you either? Well, do you have any idea what you might have done?
I probably would have gone into medicine.
Huh.
Of some sort. I doubt I would have gone for an MD at that point. But I really have no idea. I have no idea. Maybe I'd have gone into business. Who knows?
Well, it's interesting how pivotal that became to you, his welcoming into the field at that point in time. You know, sometimes we don't realize the effect we have on other people. So did you ever tell him how pivotal that was?
I think so, yeah. We had Hartsook had a tremendous influence on me. He did on all the people that he taught. In my later years, when I was working at the university, Rice had their first ever fundraising effort where they really went out and tried to raise money from the graduates. And Kobayashi, the man that I worked with, they had funding for a chair in chemical engineering, the Lewis Calder chair, and he was appointed to the chair. So as soon as he was appointed, he said, "I want to raise money for our Hartsook chair." And so we got a list of all of the people who had engineering degrees under Professor Hartsook. There were about 900 of them. And we had to raise a half a million. No, that's not right. Whatever it was, big, it was a lot of money. A lot of money. And all of the big donors had already been contacted at this point. And so we got this list, and Ricky wrote letters and made phone calls, and we went to see people, and we made trips, and we would knock on the door of the refinery or the chemical plant and find all of these people. And we raised the money and established the Hartsook Chair in Chemical Engineering. And I wrote letters, and he wrote letters. And one letter I remember so well, this is part of why I'm so adamant about the prejudice thing. The one letter that we had that influenced me a lot was from a man who was a Jew, and he wrote back that when he had finished his degree in 1939, that Professor Hartsook advised him, don't bother trying to get a job on the channel. Nobody will hire you, you're a Jew. Go back up east to get a job. Well, the man resented that he had gotten this advice. But you see, Professor Hartsook was very practical. He knew that's what he had to do to get a job. And we raised all the money and we found chemical engineers. One was the vice governor of Oregon, a man and woman who finished classmates in the mid-40s, head of a shrimp boat fleet out of Corpus. One man is a bishop in the Episcopal Church. And then every major oil and gas company in the United States had at least one chemical engineer in the upper echelon of the company. And every time we went out and we would know that somebody worked at the plant, and we would knock on the plant door, and the person that would come out would be the manager of the plant. It happened over and over and over again. It was truly amazing. And so we had a special, you know, night of award of this, and everybody came, and the man had, everybody respected him so highly. Professor Hartsook was a really very fine person. He was really interested. He knew all of his students. He kept everybody's names, where they were, what they were doing, and very, very caring person. He's an interesting part of the history of science now. Hartsook got his first degree in mathematics and was a mathematics teacher. Then he went back to MIT and studied with the big names, Lewis, and you know the ones that we have, those antique books from MIT, the antique professors.
Yes,
I'm sure you'd know the names if I could think of them. Anyway, he studied with them, got mimeographed copies of their books. See, this would have been in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And then he came back and he started the chemical engineering department at Rice. And so he had a master's in chemical engineering, and yet he started and grew the department to what it was.
And
he was tremendous. He was tremendous. Fascinating person.
And was it also during this time that you met Ricky Kobayashi?
Yes, Kobayashi. I had Ricky as an instructor for my phase behavior course, and respected him very highly. And he became very ill with a brain tumor while I was a student during, I guess it was the end of my junior year or something like that. And they treated it with radiation and put a shunt down the back of his neck to equalize the pressure between the head, what was in his head and what was in the spinal column. And he had this place on each side of his head where the radiation had been done, where the hair just went down. He was a genius before. Afterwards, he was just a very, very brilliant man. He ended up a member of the National Academy. And
was that unusual then to have a professor that, he was first generation Japanese American?
I think it's pretty unusual, don't you?
Yeah.
His father was an engineer. But when he came here, he couldn't work as an engineer. And that's when he became a truck farmer.
His father. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
His father had returned to Japan and gotten a Japanese bride and brought her back. And so Ricky was quite a character. I could tell Ricky stories all night. He was riding on a train in Japan, and so he ordered eggs. He thought he ordered 3 2-minute eggs. Two 3-minute eggs. He got 3 2-minute eggs. He he and Tom were sitting one time talking something at a hotel at Philadelphia Airport or some such place. And they called the plane and everything. The plane took off and they just kept talking. And when I went to work for the, at the end of my career, when I was working for the engineering company, Ricky was a consultant there. And we had this one brilliant guy, absolutely genius on doing sweetening plants, amine plants. And you know, he was still working away. So here's this voice talking. And this guy, when he worked, many engineers do this. When they work, they kind of go down in this little hole and you start talking to them and they, what's going on? Ricky had come in, did what he usually did, resumed the conversation they'd been having 2 weeks before, the exact point where they stopped off. He was a character.
So was it, you said the you enjoyed the class.
I found the topic phase behavior very fascinating.
What fascinated you?
We'd all work together.
Oh.
That was the part, I ended up doing a lot of work in that field when I was working with him, of course, and we made a wonderful discovery, double retrograde condensation. It was fascinating. And you know, where the K values ended, and that was one of my highlights. Ricky called me one night, the binary K system. They feel vapor liquid equilibrium is expressed in terms of K, the ratio of the vapor to the liquid. And we have, you know, drawings of what the curves look. If you have a binary system, Ricky called me one night and said that the high pressure N was the vapor pressure of the lowest. It wasn't known until Ricky did that. And when he called me that night, I said immediately that the other end was the low pressure point of the two components that was there. That, before everybody's charts of this binary system looked like this. And when we were through, you could do it like this and like this. And we knew which way they went. We discovered that in one night. That was one of the highlights of my career that night. I knew it immediately. And it had to be that way.
He wasn't going to say that. He was going to say something else.
No, he was talking about the high pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew what the low pressure was.
Yeah.
Once he said the high pressure, I knew immediately what the low pressure was.
Yeah.
Now, I had aha moments in my research. Not everybody does this. But that was one of them. And the other one was the Burnett experiment. Which was, well, I think it's, Mr. Burnett was a New Hampshire, I think. At any rate, he developed a way of measuring the density at various pressures and temperature. And from this, we can develop how a particular gas, I'll use the term gas, behaves and what its density is and everything. And then from that, you go back to your basic physical chemistry, and we have a thing called virial coefficients, that second virial coefficients is what the first thing that you derive from information like this. But if you have sufficient information, and it's good, it has to be high quality data, not this is 6 inches type of data, where you just hold up your hand and say that's 6 inches between it. You got to really know that that is 6.0000 inches type of stuff. Well, with the Burnett experiment, you could get data that could really find that. And I went in one day, and Gary Pope was doing his things, and he said he had figured out that the particular apparatus that we had developed, that if he would charge it up to the exact same conditions and change it, that they would be connected, the 2 points, and then the 2 expansions would be connected. And when he did this, I told him, if you do that, the entire matrix is connected. Mm-hmm. And he spent the weekend working on the equations. And I came in, and this was a major breakthrough, because then we could measure virial coefficients, third virial coefficients, which heretofore had been measured with like plus or minus 400, 500%. and it was down like, I don't know, 2 or 3%. So it was a huge, huge improvement. And I can remember both instances and how, well, it was just exciting.
Well, I mean, those are kind of contributions maybe taken for granted now, because it's interesting to hear your side, hear the story from you.
What do you mean they're taken for granted?
Well, it's what we're taught, right?
You mean it's being taught now?
It's what you helped create,
but now
it's just taught.
Oh, you were just taught it. Oh, I'm sorry.
That's what I mean. So.
Well, that's what's even more amazing is we did a lot of work with Ricky and Gas Hydrates and the crystallography. Do you know that crystallographers used to just sit and think to try to figure out what the configuration. Nowadays they have all this X-ray technology and everything, and then get actual pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And used to, they just had to sit and think. And the hydrate lattice is very complex.
Mm-hmm.
It's involves dodecahedra and hexadecimal. It's very complex. And the guys that figured it out, one of the early workers was a man. And that's the thing about it; these breakthroughs can come in weird places. It was a man with the Illinois Water Authority, and he figured out the most complex structure. Yes. And one of a Nobel Prize winner went and tried to steal his work. That's one of my other pieces of information.
I think we do want to dive into those maybe tomorrow.
Yeah.
Let's see, what else do you want to know about rice?
So when you finished Rice and you talked a little bit about getting kind of the job at Shell, so was that a validation of, chemical engineering was the right thing for you, or?
But when I started, I was really interested in what I was doing, and I was learning a lot about how the refinery worked, of course, and everything about that, learning a lot, and my colleagues were all very helpful to me and very interested in treating me equally. It was really good.
So looking back, you feel it was the right pick?
Oh, yes, it was definitely the right pick for me. Okay. I like doing puzzles. I like making things and integrating things. I like managing things. I like new ideas. I like new challenges.
Was chemical engineering what you thought it was? Like, if you go back to that freshman at Rice going, what am I doing with my future?
I didn't know what it was. I think what I learned what chemical engineering is, it's about taking matter and making it useful for humanity. And that's pretty important. It's pretty important. And it can be everything from making a piece of paper to treating garbage to making rocket fuel. It's a very, very wide field. And I learned I worked with so many different people of different backgrounds over the years. And then working in the engineering company itself and actually working with the different disciplines and seeing how I think a chemical engineer appreciates more the integration of the need for all specialties than the other engineers. That's why chemical engineers make good project engineers, make good managers, general managers. You know, you have to be aware of everything that's going on. I used to tell our graduate students and postdocs that they needed to record the phases of the moon when they're taking their data, because they'll never know when they go back to analyze it what influenced them to do that, and maybe it was the phase of the moon. Figuratively speaking, of course.
So why did you not go stay in academia and kind of, you got the BA and then there was a BS,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Well, I do not have an advanced degree.
Did you ever think about it?
Oh, yes, I did. But I was very busy with, I had a mental illness. And when I was with my last pregnancy, I had a grand mal seizure, and that led to severe depression. They didn't know what caused it. I had to have a hysterectomy, and I was had depression off and on for 5 years. And after that, it just really wasn't practical. And I was doing something I really enjoyed, and doing things. Why did I leave academia? I finally realized that because I did not have a doctorate, that I would never be accepted as a full faculty member. I was never on the faculty, see? I never had a faculty position. And I got, we went abroad for a year with my husband's work, and I found out during that year that I was regarded worldwide as preeminent in my profession, and yet I wasn't recognized on campus. Mm-hmm. And I came back and had an incident with Ricky that made me realize that, you know, I would never receive recognition on campus, and so I decided to leave.
So going back to your scientific experience at Rice, did you have lab experience of any kind in your high school science education? And then what was it like when you were at Rice in terms of sort of hands-on lab experience?
Well, I'm sure we did some sort of lab in high school, but I don't remember. It was very inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
At Rice, we did the science courses that I took, I'm sure were standard for the university. I mean, you get a sample and you have to analyze it, and you have to go out and you have to measure, balance your, remember weighing all those things for analytical chemistry, and you have to balance all the little weights and you learn all the techniques and everything. But it's learning to do the drawings and all. Yeah, we learn to use a drawing, but that's what you have to learn is how to think, and how to analyze, and how to integrate a lot of different information into I had to be very, very good at that. Look, you take home ec and you do some sewing and you learn how to sew, but you really don't know how to sew.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn how to cook something, and maybe you can cook one thing, but you really don't know until you really get out and you do a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
And I think that my education at Rice was so based on learning the fundamentals, more so than actually. Although we had in our chem labs, I mean, we ran a filter press and we had a tower that we had to do and all this stuff. But you really, when you learn to drive, you know how to drive, right? But when do you really know that? Have you been driving about 5 years?
I don't know how much you're in touch with that. I know you've been involved with Rice throughout the years.
Oh, yes.
And you have a daughter that's in a different part of engineering and involved in teaching. But do you have any advice for what's going on today in terms of kind of that rigor or academia period for students and what they should really be focused on?
I don't know whether they it's still emphasized or not. I hope it is. The emphasis in chemical engineering now, of course, is going into the bio-apps space, really. Tremendous pressure there, to the point that they've changed the name to, you're no longer the chemical engineering, you're chemical and bioengineering department.
Mm-hmm.
Which is ridiculous when you realize that chemical engineering is the father of bioengineering, is the father of environmental engineering, is the father of ocean engineering, my daughter's specialty.
Hmm.
chemical engineering is back of all of those. And I firmly believe that your first engineering degree should be in the basic electrical, mechanical, civil, chemical engineering. I think it's a mistake. I think my daughter made a mistake to major in environmental, ocean, space, paper. I mean, paper is another substance. Any of these, the basic information that you need for engineering is to learn how to think and how to integrate and how to bring things together. And that's common in the fork. And if you're taking one of these specialties, you're going to miss out on some of the basics of whatever you need. I advise people, when I'm trying to advise them, get your basic degree in that, and you say you want to be go into space. First get your degree in mechanical engineering, or whatever, and then go into get an advanced degree. That's my philosophy.
It's a little bit about how physics is challenging if you don't have the calculus, right, ahead of time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yes, I guess it's somewhat like that. And I don't know. Of course, my daughter didn't pay any attention to me.
So at your period at Rice, were there women on the faculty?
Yes, we had some in the math department, colleagues and a husband. There were none in the engineering department. There are now. Math is where they first broke in. We had Catherine Fisher Drew in the history department. She's a very prominent historian.
And did you have any of these professors who were women? Did you have any professors who were women during your...
No, I didn't take the history courses beyond that one course I had to take. No, I didn't have any women instructors.
Did you have any role models as you got through your primary, secondary education?
Can't think of anybody.
In a way, you were your own role model.
I don't know. It's there weren't that many people. I guess the most outstanding role model I ever had, I met after, after I got married and when I started working for Kobayashi. It was in 58, I guess it'd be 4 years after I graduated, when I met Lillian Gilbreth.
Oh.
Do you know who Lillian Gilbreth is?
No.
She is, are you familiar with the movie Cheaper by the Dozen?
Mm-hmm.
She's the mother in Cheaper by the Dozen.
Ah.
She also had her doctorate in psychology. And her husband were the founders of industrial engineering. Industrial engineering is time and motion study and when he died, she took over the business and continued it and spoke. And when we formed Society of Women Engineers shortly after I graduated here in Texas, and we had a chapter, I think we had 9 or 10 people, I don't remember exactly. And she came to Houston to talk to our very small group of people. Mm-hmm. And she stayed at the Plaza Hotel. And I remember when we met her, we were surprised that she didn't have a traveling companion with her, because she was elderly at that time. I guess she must have been in her 80s. You'd be surprised to see me traveling by myself, right? But she was, and she was getting ready to go on a 6-week lecture tour of Europe when she left us. She was flying directly to Europe. Her luggage was an over-the-shoulder bag for a 6-week tour.
Wow.
Most efficient person I've ever known.
I was going to say, practice what she creates, right?
Exactly. And really, if you haven't read, she wrote a book that you really ought to get in if you haven't read it. It's on designing of kitchens for the handicapped people, which is, of course, you bring the material down to their level where they can reach to, and very to me, it made me understand the importance of industrial engineering more than anything. But she had a tremendous, meeting her was a tremendous impact on me. Now, I just knew her, you know, that one time, and I think then I saw her when we had the National Convention of SWE here in 59. And she came and spoke at that, so I met her then.
Something. Yeah, and I was wondering about, you had, when you were in high school, you know, you're really involved in acting and things related to theater. Did you do anything related to that at Rice, or was that something you sort of left behind?
My only extracurricular activity at Rice was my literary society that I would go to, and occasionally I would have a date.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I went to the football game, so you didn't have to have a date for that, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't do a lot of dating at Rice. I was too busy.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to school 5.5 days a week, and and you have to start studying again on Sunday afternoon.
So you talked about getting a job out of Rice, but talk about graduation. Like, how did that feel, or what was graduation? Did your family come?
Oh, yes, yes, of course. Well, when I got my engineering degree, they came both years, but my engineering degree, there was another young lady on campus who was in the Naval ROTC. Very unusual, there's one. So when they have graduation, they always like to write these special people, you know, the guy that's the old grandmother, the old grandfather that's gone back at 75 to get his degree and this sort of thing. Well, she and I were the unusual items that year. And so there's a picture of me and her with Willie's statue on the front page of the Houston Chronicle, because I got the engineering degree and she got the naval commissioning degree.
Did you like that attention, or was it just kind of?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of fun, you know. And I've got the one there, my picture, that's the McDermott publication when I was working for them. They publicized that they had me working for them. And I got another picture in there. That the first year after I graduated, it was Engineers Week. And so Shell, this is where Shell exploited me, being a woman. And I've got a picture of me using my high heel to tack up a notice of Engineers Week. You know, publicity. They use it. Because that was used. And then the year after me, we had a girl get her engineering degree in mechanical engineering. She was the first one in mechanical engineering. And she got a job with Hudson, Humboldt Oil. I guess that's what they were called there.
Mm-hmm.
But they strictly hired her to be look, we've got a woman. And she realized it after about a year and a half and left them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think Shell was giving me a fair chance to be what I wanted to be.
And how was your family reacting to your, you know, getting your degree and to this next step in your education or in your career? How were they responding?
Depends on who do you mean by family? You mean my mother and father?
Yeah, or whoever you want to.
When I got my engineering degree, remember I told you about my father, and then money was tight.
Mm-hmm.
And I was living in a boarding house at that time. And they called and said, we needed one to come and see me. This was before graduation. And they came in and he gave me a diamond wristwatch.
Mm.
He was very, very proud of me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's almost making me cry.
Well, Daddy was, I had a wonderful father, and he backed me up all the way, and he died when he was 60 years old. You know, he smoked cancer. So. Now that was when he died. I had three little girls, and I wanted, you know, well, in January he had a medical checkup, he was okay. In February he lost weight,
went back to the doctor in March. On San Jacinto Day, they operated and found liver cancer, patched him up and sent him home. On Mother's Day, my aunt calls me, Patsy, if you want to be with your dad, you need to come now. And in less than an hour, I left my three little girls with my two best friends that were in this book here at the end of my party. And one of them took the little baby, and one took the two old ones. And I went out there on Monday, and he died on Friday. If you have two friends like that, I am rich. You know, my daddy never got to see, you know, what happened in my lifetime. My mother did, and I'm glad she did. She was very proud of me, too. Very, very proud of me.
Did they understand what your work was?
I don't know. Does anybody understand what your work was?
No.
I think as much as you can understand what somebody else's work is, yes, they did.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure they saw you working hard.
Yeah, they saw me working very hard and doing things and getting things done. Anyway, it was good. It was a good life.
And since then, or maybe it was while you were at Rice, I thought I saw that there was some emphasis on STEM. Were they trying to attract new
people? Now?
It was
years
Rice
ago.
Open house.
Okay. When I was a student at Rice, we had a annual science fair type of thing. Where we tried to promote science and engineering to the community. And one of the things we did, I remember one year, maybe we did that one year I was there, or 2 years, I can't remember for sure. But we did have a STEM activity where we invited the people to come in. And in chemical engineering, we had a pressure machine that took resin and molded it into an ashtray. And we made these ashtrays and of course it was a very simple thing to use, and they taught all of us undergrads how to do it pretty quick. It wasn't that hard to learn. And so we were there and we were passing out these ashtrays to the kids that came along. That was the STEM activity that we did. Personally, I started very early. The earliest I remember doing any that type of encouraging activity was, must have been 57 or 58 when I participated in a Junior Engineering Society, the women in the Junior Engineering Society at Beaumont College. What is that one called there? What is that university? Anyway, I remember driving over there, and one time I went over to talk to them and all, and I came back, and I almost ran out of gas on the highway. Oh, that was funny. But that was my first participation in trying to encourage. And over the years, I've encouraged, you know, as I could, different things.
Do you remember seeing girls in some of these?
I saw a few girls, and I talked to them. Okay. And later on, I've had two or three occasions that I've, out of the blue, I'll get an email or something, a note saying, thank you for saying whatever you did to me, so-and-so, and I don't even know what they're talking about, you know, but I did that. Since my daughter is, decided to go into education very shortly after she did, I started going and judging for her. One of the things they teach at the junior college is an introductory course on how to pass in college. They make everybody do this nowadays. I didn't know that. But apparently it's essential. And the ones for the people who are going into science and engineering is taught by the engineering department. And part of it that they do is they're given a project of some sort to do, and then they have to make a written report, if they can make a model, they make a model, and then they have to go up and give an oral report. And the oral report, she started the practice of bringing in real people to critique them. And I was, so I've been doing that now for a number of years. And it's quite interesting, quite interesting.
So and I'm wondering if now would be a good time to take a break or try it off camera for a moment, off the recorder.
Great.